This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Military says it has launched a missile attack on an Aramco oil station in the Saudi city of Jeddah. Iran urges Britain, France, and Germany to fulfill their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if they want Tehran to stop its countermeasures. A U.S. Navy admiral pays an unannounced visit to Taiwan despite earlier warnings by China against such moves. The Yemeni military says it has targeted an Aramco oil distribution station in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the targeted facility is located in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. Sari said the attack was a legitimate response to what he described as Saudi crimes and aggression against Yemen. The spokesman also warned foreign companies working in Saudi Arabia to exercise caution as operations will continue. The Yemeni army and allied Ansarullah movement have carried out attacks on Saudi Arabia in retaliation for a bloody war imposed on the Arab country by Riyadh that has been ongoing since 2015. Well, I'll be discussing this a little bit further with Mr. Nasser Shaker. He's a Yemeni activist and political commentator who joins us via Skype out of the Yemeni capital of Sana'a. Thank you very much, Nasser, for joining Press TV. Tell me what you think about this recent move by the Yemeni military.
Well, this is the first attack by Yemen's armed forces against Saudi Arabia to bring Saudi Arabia to the negotiating table, because Saudi Arabia is refusing to come to the negotiating table to stop its aggression in Yemen and lift the blockade and allow Yemeni dialogue. Saudi Arabia has been targeting Yemen since 2015, and the international community has been silent. Now, I don't want the international community to bleed or to outcry for this attack, because Saudi Arabia is bleeding oil. They have been silent when the Yemeni children were bleeding blood. Saudi Arabia should understand that only Yemeni bureaucratic dialogue can end the war in Yemen. And only Yemen can bring peace to Saudi Arabia, because the Zionist Americans own the mercenaries that are installed on the borders between Yemen and Saudi Arabia to protect its borders with Yemen and the disputed regions of Najran, Asir, and Jizan. These regions are another Nagorno-Karabakh on where Armenia was forced to leave, these territories, and Armenia and Azerbaijan was able to control these regions. Now Saudi Arabia should leave these regions, and Saudi Arabia should understand that only Yemen can bring peace to this country.
What kind of a reaction do you think this recent attack will bring about on the part of the Saudis?
Well, the Saudis, we have seen that the Saudis are very happy with the attack. There are a lot of Saudis are supporting Yemenis against this regime, because this regime is dictator. And we have seen citizens last night have been filming the attack on the oil distribution facility of Aramco in Jeddah. They were happy. They were filming, and now Twitter is burning with the videos by the citizens. There are a lot of Saudi citizens are happy with this attack. Even the Saudi is preventing and arresting Saudi citizens for filming any attack by Yemenis. I think Saudis will be able in the future to film more attacks, as Yemen is warning Saudi Arabia, especially the foreigners in Saudi Arabia and the foreign firms, to be aware and be cautious. And I would like to send the message to take these warnings seriously, because the future will carry more attacks unless Saudi Arabia stop its aggression, lift the siege and blockade in Yemen, and allow Yemeni dialogue.
And Nasser, one last thing before I let you go. Of course, Aramco, being one of the largest oil facilities in the world, it's the second time that it's coming under attack after first it was bombed last year. What kind of a message do you think it sends to the markets in the world, especially, you know, to the partners who are working with Saudi Arabia in the oil sector?
This attack is going to send a message that Ansarullah are targeting Saudi targets and will not target any foreign firms before targeting all Saudi targets. Ansarullah has been serious, are accurate in their attacks against Saudi firms. There were no single Saudi or a foreigner or expatriates in Saudi Arabia. But if you look at the Saudi attacks in Yemen, a lot of citizens, a lot of children, a lot of foreigners, Russians, be it Russians or Indians, and refugees in Yemen were attacked during Saudi attacks. So this country has highly sophisticated weapons, but Ansarullah, using their domestically built missiles and drones, have been able to target Saudi firms accurately without causing any collateral damage to citizens.
Okay, thank you very much, Nasser Shakir, Yemeni activist and political commentator via Skype out of Sana'a. Let's move on to another story now. Iran says it'll undo its commitment rollbacks under the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, only if the European signatories honor their commitments. Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organization stressed that the E3 needs to restore balance to the landmark accord by working to lift sanctions against Tehran. Qasem Gharibabadi blamed the challenges facing the JCPOA on the U.S. move to unilaterally withdraw from the deal, as well as the Europeans' failure to make up for Washington's reimposition of sanctions. Gharibabadi criticized the European party's inaction on U.S. measures, while Tehran remained fully committed to the nuclear agreement even a year after Washington's illegal withdrawal. The envoy dismissed the West's criticism of Iran's commitment cuts, noting that its retaliatory measures are in accordance with the terms of the JCPOA. Political analyst Alexander Ozodgun says European governments lack the political will and the economic leverage to counter U.S. measures against the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
Regardless of the good cop, bad cop, Jekyll and Hyde game, which is what we've seen between Washington and EU, I think our European colleagues, there's a lack of political will when it comes to Iran. They've been engaging when it comes to the Iranian nuclear accord, In practice, we have been witnessing a lack of political will, like I said, as well as the economic leverage that the Europeans seem to not have over Washington. This is really huge monetarily, the volume of trade between Europe and Washington. Nevertheless, I think Iran is providing in once again an opportunity for our European counterparts to develop this, develop their backbone. As the saying goes, one should have should never miss an opportunity during a crisis. And we've been in a state of crisis with Iran for at least 6 years since JCPOA was signed in July of 2015. And it would be very short-sighted of the Europeans to miss this opportunity once again to commence the long process of geopolitical and geoeconomic autonomy from Washington. I think ultimately at the end, Europeans, at least the transatlantic alliance, their ship will all the same sail in the same direction as Washington, and everything else is a fluff. But on the same token, the Europeans are interested to establish some autonomy from the transatlantic alliance. They're tired of being under the yoke of Washington.
Taiwan says a senior U.S. official has paid an unannounced visit to the self-ruled island, a move that is expected to anger China. Although Taipei has not specified who the official was, Reuters cited sources as saying U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Michael Stuteman was on a trip there. Well, he's the director of the agency that oversees intelligence at the U.S. military's Indo-Pacific Command. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has recently ramped up support for Taiwan, including with the approval of new arms sales and high-level visits. China has long warned against such moves by the U.S., saying it can harm Beijing-Washington relations. China considers Taiwan a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. Author and columnist Einar Tangen says U.S. President Donald Trump is creating problems that will be difficult to resolve in the near future.
But if you talk to Douglas Paul, who was former head of the Taiwan Relations Office, he'll say this move is unprecedented. So it's not clear what signal is being sent or why this admiral was suddenly showing up there. But it's very clear that the Trump administration is trying to leave as many poison pills as possible for the next incoming president, Joe Biden. The fact that it was leaked that you can trace the airplane back to the Hawaiian headquarters of J2 going directly to Taiwan, although it was unmarked. What's wrong with the telephone? What's wrong with a video conference? This was some sort of show by somebody, and it was instigated. But it's not probable that it would be coming from the Pentagon itself, because this would be extremely sensitive. It would, in essence, be tying the hands of Joseph Biden.
The United States is reportedly planning to restrict a host of Chinese companies from buying American goods and technology over their alleged links with the Chinese military. Officials in Washington and Beijing have yet to comment on the Reuters report, but if the list is published, it could escalate a trade war between the two largest economies and hurt many firms selling aviation parts to China. A Chinese aircraft maker, which has been trying to compete with American aerospace giant Boeing, is also on the list. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has stepped up its anti-China measures in recent months, targeting firms including social media apps. Over a week ago, Trump issued an executive order prohibiting investments in companies that support the Chinese military. U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign appeals a ruling that clears the way for the state of Pennsylvania to certify Joe Biden as the winner of the November election. The campaign asked a court to review a decision by U.S. District Judge that is Matthew Brand. Brand on Saturday dismissed a lawsuit that sought to invalidate more than 2 million mail-in votes in the battleground state. Pennsylvania is expected to certify its election results on Monday. The appeal is the latest effort by the Trump campaign to overturn his defeat in the election, which Trump has refused to concede over fraud allegations. This is while the projected winner of the U.S. presidential election, Biden, is set to name his first cabinet picks on Tuesday. His chief of staff, Ron Klain, says that he has already decided on the Treasury Secretary nomination. Elsewhere in the world, health officials in the Gaza Strip warned that the besieged enclave could see a sharp rise in COVID-19 cases that would overwhelm its meager medical system. A member of Gaza's pandemic task force said the enclave has 100 ventilators, of which almost 80 are taken up. The official added that with the current growing rate of infections, patients would not find a place at intensive care units. The densely populated enclave has long suffered under an Israeli blockade, which has severely restricted delivery of much-needed medicine and food. Official data shows more than 14,000 Gazans have so far contracted the novel coronavirus, with the death toll standing at 65. Thousands of people in Pakistan have held a rally to condemn Israel and India for committing atrocities in the occupied Palestine and Kashmir. The angry protesters called for armed resistance against both Israel and India to end their decades-long occupation and ever-growing sufferings of the Muslims in the occupied territories. Javed Rana is in Rawalpindi.
A large number of people turned up in the garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistani capital Islamabad. These angry youngsters were outraged against India over its alleged unending brutalities against Muslims in disputed Kashmir region. So were they resentful against Israel for suppressing Muslims in the occupied Palestine. Equally, these protesters are angry with the rulers of many Arab states over their alleged collaboration with India and particularly with Israel in strengthening their illegal hold of territories belonging to the Muslims. But it seems for these protesters, there is a leadership vacuum in the Muslim world. This protest was organized by Youth Parliament, an organization of students of colleges and universities from all over Pakistan. They have been campaigning to forge greater unity among Muslims across their racial and sectarian profiling and regions. With greater unity among the ranks and files of Muslims, these students are struggling to bring an end to the atrocities being committed against Muslims by reviving the true spirit of Muslim nationhood all over the Islamic world.
We will never accept Israel. They are bombarding on the small children in the Palestine. They are Muslims. We are standing with them and they are looking for the Pakistan, that they should come for the help for the Palestine.
The protesters sounded disappointed with the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who won last general elections partially with the pledge to pursue Muslim causes. Muslim causes in the world appears to be what matters to the common people in Pakistan. The lingering public resentment against France over repeated publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam is yet another cause these students have been fighting for. This protest has followed gathering of millions of people on the streets of eastern city of Lahore a few days ago. Such a huge crowd emerged to attend the funeral of Khadim Hussain Rizvi, a religious and political leader who through his sustained protest forced Prime Minister Imran Khan last week to ink an agreement with his government to expel French ambassador and officially boycott French products in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Rawalpindi.
Days after Canberra confirmed war crimes by Australian forces in Afghanistan, rights bodies and locals in Afghanistan want justice.
According to many independent institutions like Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, some Australian troops have committed crimes against humanity, such as intentionally killing civilians, since the beginning of America's longest war in Afghanistan back in 2001. A recent report on Australian forces' potential war crimes in Afghanistan has provoked reactions from Afghan institutions. Afghanistan's Human Rights Commission has condemned the killing of civilians by Australian troops and urged the prosecution of those responsible for the crimes. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has dismissed as an inhuman move the killing of dozens of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Unfortunately, Australian forces have brutally killed civilians, including men, women and children in Uruzgan province. In fact, it proves that the lives of the Afghan women, men, and children have no human value or dignity for them. Unfortunately, 39 civilians were killed by Australian forces during their 11 years presence in Afghanistan.
This comes as experts believe there is not much optimism that independent investigations would be launched, even at the International Criminal Court, into the case of killing of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Although grounds are available to probe the case by the International Criminal Court, interference and pressure by certain powers have created serious obstacles in the way of launching investigations into war crimes in Afghanistan.
Based on a recent report released by the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, more than 32,000 civilians were killed and around 60,000 others, including women and children, were injured over the last decade. That is why the UN body also believes it's time to put an end to this human tragedy and misery by struggling to bring peace to the war-ravaged country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Well, that'll do for me.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, than fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The oldest Republican in the Senate tested positive for it. The oldest member of the House was hospitalized with it. And several more lawmakers have announced they have either been diagnosed with the coronavirus or are quarantining after exposure to it in what is threatening to become a mini outbreak on Capitol Hill that has already disrupted the business of Congress. Senator Charles E. Grassley, Republican of Iowa, 87 years old, on Tuesday became the latest lawmaker to be affected, announcing that he had tested positive. His absence helped to temporarily derail the confirmation of President Trump's nominee for the Federal Reserve Board and shattered Mr. Grassley's pride and joy, the longest consecutive voting streak in Senate history. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Emily Cochrane. The piece is titled, "As Grassley Tests Positive, Virus Threatens to Stall Work in Congress." Stay with us for more of Emily Cochrane's article. Two of the oldest members of Congress, Senator Charles E. Grassley of Iowa and Representative Don Young of Alaska, now have the coronavirus, underscoring the risks on Capitol Hill. The oldest Republican in the Senate tested positive for it. The oldest member of the House was hospitalized with it, and several more lawmakers have announced they have either been diagnosed with the coronavirus or are quarantining after exposure to it in what is threatening to become a mini outbreak on Capitol Hill that has already disrupted the business of Congress. Senator Charles E. Grassley, Republican of Iowa, 87 years old, on Tuesday became the latest lawmaker to be affected, announcing that he had tested positive. His absence helped to temporarily derail the confirmation of President Trump's nominee for the Federal Reserve Board and shattered Mr. Grassley's pride and joy, the longest consecutive voting streak in Senate history. His diagnosis came the day after Representative Don Young of Alaska, also 87 years old, disclosed that he had been hospitalized over the weekend after what he described as a particularly brutal bout with COVID-19. The twin announcements from two men whose gender and age put them at peak vulnerability of being killed by the virus underscored the risk that the lawmakers are operating under as Congress continues to meet. The marble and stone petri dish that is Capitol Hill is a vivid microcosm of the national struggle to confront and contain the spread of the pandemic, with partisan bickering often thwarting already unevenly enforced health precautions. Having effectively declared themselves essential workers, the nation's lawmakers, a group of older Americans whose jobs involve weekly flights, ample indoor contact, and near constant congregating in close quarters, are yet again struggling to adapt their legislative and ceremonial routines to stem the spread of the coronavirus, even as it rages within their ranks. As of Tuesday afternoon, 17th of November, both Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, and Charles E. Grassley were in quarantine as a result of possible exposure, marking the first time Mr. Grassley had missed a vote since 1993. In the House, Don Young, who noted on Monday that he was alive, feeling better, and on the road to recovery after being discharged, is among four lawmakers who have revealed they contracted the virus in the past month. More than 80 members of Congress have either tested positive, quarantined, or come into contact with someone who had the coronavirus, according to GovTrack. In a memo issued Sunday evening, Dr. Brian P. Monahan, the attending physician for Capitol Hill, informed lawmakers that his office would provide rapid tests that would produce results within 6 to 12 hours, to lawmakers and staff returning to the nation's capital. The testing, an expansion largely prompted by a travel order issued by Mayor Muriel Bowser of the District of Columbia that requires travelers to obtain a test after arrival in Washington, is voluntary. But stark divisions remain on how to handle the pandemic in the capital. Even as states are experiencing the highest number of cases ahead of an expected brutal winter, let alone on how to address its toll across the country. Over the loud objections of Republicans, House Democrats created a proxy voting system that they announced this week would be in effect through the end of the year, but Senate Republicans have yet to impose any alternative to voting in person on the floor of the Senate. The two chambers have never reconciled their varying positions on whether face masks should be required whilst voting. They are required on the floor of the Democratic-led House, but they are only strongly recommended in the Republican-controlled Senate. Several Republicans, including lawmakers who have had COVID-19, continue to resist wearing face masks elsewhere on Capitol Hill. And a nasty spat broke out about the practice on Monday on the normally decorous Senate floor. Late last week, House Democratic leaders abruptly transformed an elaborate dinner in statutory hall for their new members into a grab-and-go meal after facing a backlash online and internally for hosting such an event when most Americans are being warned to curtail or cancel their holiday plans. And during orientation for new lawmakers, which had been largely subdued because of the coronavirus, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a QAnon-backing Republican, proudly announced in the middle of a discussion of pandemic safety that she had denounced face coverings. It is a dynamic that bodes poorly for attendance in the waning days of the 116th Congress. On Tuesday, the absence of Mr. Grassley and Mr. Scott temporarily stalled the confirmation of Judy Shelton, Donald Trump's Federal Reserve nominee, after Republicans fell short of the support necessary to advance to a final vote. There's this kind of macho, "well, I'm not afraid of COVID" thing going on, said Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, who has one of the longest congressional commutes and has instructed his entire staff to work remotely. "We have to run the government. That's our obligation. Our obligation is not to show that we're personally unafraid, because we have to pass legislation to address this crisis. And we're no good to anybody if we're sick or quarantining."
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Economic divide.
Whereas there are no exceptions when it comes to the COVID-19 virus having a devastating effect on the people and the economies of the world, for one continent, Europe, the prospect of individual nations entering a second lockdown will create a heavy burden on the governments of each country, as well as the EU, to pick up the pieces left over from shattered economies. However, recent reports that a vaccination may be on the table could come as too little too late, even if the drug is rolled out in December, as promised, as the damage has already been done. Now in the UK, for example, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer has stated that the virus is too far along the second wave to be stopped this time around.
"Frankly, we're in the middle of the second wave, and I don't see the vaccine making any difference for the wave we are now in. I'm hopeful that it may prevent future waves, but this one we have to battle through to the end without vaccine."
But what about the people of Europe? How are they reacting to the notion of a second lockdown happening? Is the prospect of facing tougher economic hardships ahead, or have lessons been learned from the previous wave of the virus that hit so hard? Just what worries the people? Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kaba Tafai. First up, on this week's episode, we will be looking at the economic impact of a second lockdown across Europe and how certain nations are dealing with the prospect. Well, it seems that there are three main issues when it comes to dealing with the notion of a second lockdown across major towns and cities across Europe. The first is the most startling, namely, the lack of government preparation. Although all have been through it once, it seems that major infrastructures are still not ready for a second wave, with schools, universities, and hospitals all left in the dark as to what may happen. Secondly, there's the real problem of having a weakened economy to deal with the virus. During the first wave, major European economies took a hit, with the likes of the UK seeing the worst hit, with a 25% drop in their GDP.
The rest of Europe saw an overall decline of around 9 to 12% on average. Hence, a second wave will mean less spending power in fighting the virus than first time around. And finally, there's the notion of European unrest. That's right. Unrest is happening because the center is not holding, with extreme polls emerging over the handling of the virus. Already, most major European nations have seen protests against the measures being taken by governments. For businesses alone, the EU has already forked out 540 billion euros. But can it, A, afford another such bailout, and B, will the people of Europe be expected to pay the sum back in taxes? Challenging questions, I'm sure you'll agree.
France, much like the rest of Europe, has been no stranger to the devastating impact caused by the coronavirus, with the country seeing 1.92 million people infected and over 43,000 deaths at the time of writing, a number that will no doubt rise as the second wave of the pandemic sweeps across Europe. France was one of the first few nations in Europe to enter a lockdown at the start of the year, with the economic costs on the country costing billions of euros as bars, restaurants, leisure facilities and more closed down, putting at risk 15% of the total 220,000 registered hospitality companies in the country at a risk of closing permanently, which in turn will of course cost hundreds of thousands of jobs, with France 24 News stating that the figures may be as high as 250,000 people. The French government has tried to assist by providing various sources of economic assistance, with small businesses, such as cafes, being able to apply for solidarity grants of up to 10,000 euro. There's also a furlough scheme which offers up to 100% of salaries planned up to the end of December, as well as a series of government-backed loans. But to date, the cost of the virus has set back the French GDP by 13.8%, a figure that puts a dent in the side of Macron's budget. But as the second wave does its damage, the French government have realised that there's no choice but to introduce a full second lockdown, something that the French Prime Minister, Jean Castex, has stated will initially last 15 days, but could increase. For France, the harsh reality of a recession is on the cards, as the second lockdown will no doubt be a painful event through the cold winter months, and is something that the UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, has warned may be a factor for all nations to consider.
How then has the EU, as a supranational entity, dealt with the COVID-19 virus on a financial scale? There is no doubt that, much like the United States, the European Central Reserves have had to take immediate action to fund some of the most under-pressure institutions. For a start, 37 billion euros has had to be redirected from the budget to support struggling healthcare systems, small and medium-sized businesses, and labor markets via a scheme called the Coronavirus Investment Initiative. Add to this a further 28 billion euros designed to be distributed to structural funds. Now, this is primarily designed to tackle major crisis response situations across the EU, which, according to the EU Commission, includes grants towards regional development, social funds, cohesion funds, agriculture, maritime, and fisheries. Furthermore, up to 800 million euros has been redirected from the EU Solidarity Fund, directed at assisting the member states most severely hit by the virus. This is also part of the adaptation on EU rules set by Brussels, which will allow member states to transfer money between funds to meet their needs, showing at least just how flexible the EU has been in dealing with the virus.
One of the worst hit nations in terms of figures and the economy at the hands of the COVID-19 virus is Britain. Again, at the time of writing, the nation has seen 1.32 million infections, with a daily infection rate of over 27,000 people per day appearing to be the norm in the second wave, and so far has tragically seen over 51,000 people lose their lives to the virus. However, it's the economic impact of the virus that's hit Britain harder than some. In fact, with the country seeing the biggest hit to its GDP compared to other leading global economies, with the country seeing a brutal reduction of around 25%, something that, along with Brexit, has essentially brought the UK Treasury to its knees. One of the biggest hit industries in Britain is the retail and leisure sector, with the second lockdown once again causing bars, restaurants, cafes and cinemas to break into a very cold sweat that will no doubt leave many business owners facing a very uncomfortable Christmas ahead and an even worse New Year as Britain comes crashing out of the EU.
It's the small businesses, the high street businesses, the one-man bands that are most at risk from this second lockdown, and that is why it's vitally important that government supports these businesses so that they are still there when we come out of this at the beginning of next year. I'm not talking next month, I'm talking about the beginning of next year.
In an attempt to help the people, the UK government had introduced a furlough scheme which offered to pay up to 80% of salaries, up to £1,800. However, so far, the scheme has cost the UK taxpayer around £30 billion and is something that, as the number of people out of work or seeing their place of work go into lockdown rises, could be a major problem for the British government, who just last week saw its two closest advisers jump from Downing Street before they were pushed. All hopes now lie on a vaccine being found in time, and for the British, sooner rather than later, as the deadline for a deal with the EU fast approaches and the UK sees themselves floating ever further away from their one-time friends around the world. But even the hopes of a vaccine appear to be as distant as a trade deal with the EU and the rest of the world for the British.
I think it's one of the reasons why we have to sort of, we had great news this last week or so on vaccines, on the mass testing program. But I think one of the reasons we have to sort of curb our enthusiasm for the moment whilst we wait for those schemes to get wide enough that we can kind of present the double whammy to the virus of hitting it both with mass testing and with a vaccine.
Well, I'm pleased to say that joining me in the studio today is Rafael de Alarcas, a professor of European and International Law from Queen Mary University in London, and holds the first ever Jean Monnet Chair in EU International Law in the UK. He's authored numerous books and articles and has served as a Marie Curie COFID Senior Research Fellow at the World Trade Institute. Professor de Alarcas, welcome to Economic Divide. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here.
So, Professor, the first question, the COVID-19 virus already seen the majority of Europe fall into a lockdown earlier this year, and with the second wave now creating a similar situation, what do you think this spells in general for the EU's economy? Will the stronger together approach pull the EU through this once again?
Well, I don't think another lockdown is necessary if we take the correct precautionary measures. I actually worry that depending on how long this new lockdown will last, it may have very serious negative effects on the European economy. And I actually worry particularly for young people and those people who are working in services such as hotels, restaurants, bars, cinemas, and theaters. So we need to avoid the great economic paralysis.
Now, you have argued that lockdowns are not necessarily needed to control the virus if the corrective preventive measures are actually taken, stating that by trying to solve a clinical or health crisis, we're creating a much bigger macroeconomic crisis. Do you think that the EU can work together to actually prevent such an issue?
I actually think that the EU, and the whole of the West, for that matter, has much to learn from the Far East. Thinking about countries such as China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, which have actually handled the COVID crisis very, very effectively. And let me give you an example. Taiwan has a population similar to that of the state of New York, around 20 million people, yet only 7 deaths have been reported as a result of COVID-19 in the case of Taiwan. Now compare that number with more than 33,000 deaths in the case of the state of New York. So I think the EU collectively should get its act together and learn from the experience of the Far East.
And finally, one of the main sectors affected by the pandemic is the hotel, catering, and leisure industries. I'm sure you'll agree, which many people employed are living on minimum wages and barely getting by. What is needed to A, protect these workers, and B, to ensure that these sectors are brought back up to speed as soon as possible?
Well, I don't think the solution is lockdown. Instead, all we need is 3 things. First, physical distancing. Second, wearing masks. And third, washing our hands frequently. If we do this, I would argue that 99% of the problem is solved. So we have a preventive and precautionary approach to COVID. There is no need for a lockdown. And that means that thousands of people will not need to lose their jobs. So the bottom line is that it all depends on our behavior.
Okay, thank you for that, Professor Rafael Leal Arcas from Queen Mary University in London. It was great to have you on the show.
It's been my pleasure.
Great, thank you. Now, don't go anywhere as we are about to take a short break here on Economic Divide. But before we go, here is what is coming up in the next part of the show. We're joined by our regular current affairs and impact analyst, Mohan Abedin, as he takes us through some of the stories making waves on social media. We'll also take a look at how the impact of the virus is taking its toll on Europe's largest economy, Germany. We'll also examine how the economic situation will play out across the rest of Europe. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Now, in this next report, let's take a look at how Germany, Europe's largest economy, is dealing with the second wave of the virus and the prospect of a second lockdown.
The largest economy in Europe, Germany, has for its size and population dealt rather well with the virus when it comes to containing it, compared to some of its European neighbours. With a total of 785,000 recorded infections so far, and only around 12,400 deaths, which, although bad, is a fraction of the likes of France and Britain, is something that the Germans have clearly managed very well. The first lockdown and major wave of the virus saw the German economy sink around 10% initially, mostly due to a closure in heavy manufacturing and industrial plants. The sink was the sharpest fall in the German GDP since 1970. The second wave of the virus has brought German Chancellor Angela Merkel no choice but to bring the nation into a second lockdown. However, they are not as far-reaching as those in France and Britain, but once again sees restaurants, bars and gyms all feeling the brunt of the measures. But as cold weather fast approaches, the reality is that German hospitals must brace themselves for the impact of the virus during the cold German winter, meaning that medical facilities may soon find themselves overwhelmed with patients and demand as the cases rise faster.
Wir müssen uns darauf einstellen, dass sich die Situation in den kommenden Wochen verschärft. Manche Kliniken könnten an ihre Grenzen kommen. Es ist möglich, dass Patienten nicht mehr überall optimal versorgt werden können. Wir müssen daher verhindern, dass sich die Situation weiter zuspitzt. Das ist meine Erwartung und wir tun alles dafür, was in unserer Macht steht, um dieses Ziel zu erreichen.
But much like other major countries in Europe, the impact of the virus is beginning to take its toll on the people, with protests against the lockdown and the tough conditions ahead being more regular, which not only raise their point to the German government, but in a double-edged sword effect, risk spreading the virus further as groups congregate to protest. What now remains to be seen is whether the economic impact of the virus across Europe is something that can be recovered once the vaccinations come into place, which for Germany, as the major power in Europe, could once again see it becoming the economic backbone in rebuilding EU member states, a job and burden that may one day tire the Germans.
Time now to bring in Mohan Abedin. He's our current affairs and impact analyst. Mohan, welcome. Tell us what you have for us today.
Right, so, I mean, COVID deaths throughout Europe. First tweet, we'll start with the UK. Highest death toll, 50,000 plus. The British government coming under increasing pressure for public health reasons. They haven't been able to save lives, but also equally important, they haven't been able to save the economy. So, and this is a big issue.
What about the way that this tweet has said, this isn't about public health versus the economy, the UK has failed to protect both. Do you agree?
Yes, broadly speaking, because they had a harsh lockdown in the spring, and everybody knew come autumn there's going to be another so-called second wave, and they didn't take the appropriate measures. They went for a 3 or 4 tier system. That didn't work. So they've now gone for a second lockdown, albeit slightly softer than the first. But still, their cases are spiraling. And of course, you have the issue of Brexit negotiations,
right.
Post-trade negotiations with the EU, a lot of uncertainty. And that's one reason I think the British government now is reluctant to completely close down the economy.
Let's move on to the next post that you picked.
Yeah, so Germany, the continent's biggest economy, huge population, You know, they've had markedly lower deaths than the UK, and yet they've taken, you know, appropriate measures to keep it down. But listen, this is all about balancing, isn't it? It's balancing public
health. Well, this particular one took a jab at the UK.
Yes.
While talking about Germany.
Exactly. But look, but the point is, it's about balancing. You balance public health with the economy. And every country is different. So in Germany, a particular set of circumstances have allowed them to keep these figures low. Now, of course, in Britain, there are plenty of critics who say, look, the Germans, they've kept the deaths very low. How come ours are very high? You know, a lot of stuff going on here. But let's not forget Britain, you know, on the one hand, you know, it's had, you know, very high deaths. But on the other, it's reluctant to, as I said, to close the economy because of all the uncertainty. Brexit is one. Another one is the election of Joe Biden as vice president. He's actually, unlike Trump, he's very pro-Brexit, and he doesn't like the way the UK is negotiating with the European
Union. Biden doesn't?
Yeah.
Really?
For a post-Brexit trade deal, because the transition period expires on the 31st of December, so the UK and EU need to have a trade agreement in place by then.
Okay.
Yeah.
Final tweet, let's take a look at that.
Yeah. So, second wave revolt. I think this is pushing it a bit. A revolt, I mean, what do you mean by a revolt?
Well, what happened in Italy? In Naples, I believe it was?
Well, there are protests against lockdown.
And you just had it in Germany, I think, a day or two
yes,
ago.
Yes, but that's not a revolt, it's a protest. And I think, yeah, protests will continue. But the Europeans, I believe, actually have a handle on this. They've handled it better than
What would
the
it
UK.
Take for a revolt, do you think?
What do you mean by revolt?
Revolt, go against the government. You're not doing anything. They want money. In other words, they need stimulus plans. They need relief plans that are not happening, even though they've been
promised. All of them have had. The UK had a stimulus plan, the so-called furlough system to save jobs, and the UK Chancellor injected £200 billion into the economy.
Or is that going to be perpetual?
I go back to what I said earlier. It's a balancing act. So you have to protect public health on the one hand, and on the other, you have to protect the economy.
Okay.
So it's a difficult balance to strike.
Yeah, it's difficult all around when dealing with a pandemic of this magnitude. Thank you so much.
We
appreciate
welcome.
That. Maan Ahmadine, our current affairs and impact analyst, thank you for his thoughts. Now, in our final report of the show, we will take a look at the wider spectrum across the EU and ascertain how some of the smaller nations in the bloc are dealing with the economic impact of the coronavirus.
With 27 member states, the EU is a strong entity, having proved this when certain member states began to struggle during previous financial crises. But how then are other states in the bloc faring when it comes to the virus? For one, Italy, as a nation which saw the worst impact of the first wave, is once again on the verge of tipping point. Protests and discontent at lockdowns and the handling of the virus have become commonplace in the Republic, and with tensions flaring, worse could yet still to come for the Italians as the virus rides a wave again across the nation. Spain, another country that saw terrible personal and economic costs caused by the virus, is no different from Italy, with the Spanish economy taking an 18.5% knock on the head during the first wave, and is likely to see a similar or worse slump as winter approaches, with much of the nation's income depending on tourism and alfresco living. Much like Germany, Italy and the UK, people have also taken to the streets in protests at the handling of the virus and the impact it's having. For some of the less well-off nations in Europe, dealing with the virus has also been a major challenge, with many nations in Eastern Europe feeling they're not as included in the EU compared to Western European states, meaning that the virus appears to have been largely ignored in comparison to other states, certainly at least on a publicity level. For southern nations in Europe, and in particular Greece, which is already struggling financially, the impact of the virus is also having a devastating effect. All hope now lies with the rapid and successful introduction, distribution, and implementation of an effective and long-lasting vaccine, something that appears to be on the horizon as Pfizer and BioNTech approach the final stages of their research, giving hope to over 350 million people around Europe, and of course, the rest of the population around the world.
The impact of the coronavirus has no doubt left families devastated at the horrific consequences of the virus, with over 52 million people infected and counting, and around 1.3 million deaths worldwide so far. Yet for Europe, the challenges that lie ahead are truly worrying. For a start, the bloc will soon see its first member leave the Union in January, as Britain cuts its final ties and Brexit becomes a reality. This could, in theory, spark other nations to do the same, leaving the European Union in jeopardy. But as the EU comes to terms with the arrival of the second wave of the virus, could this also be the catalyst that brings the EU even closer together as the bloc pulls together as pillars of unity and financial power to tackle one of the most devastating events in recent human history? But one thing is for sure, that until a vaccine arrives, the EU will be looking to cement the notion of being stronger together in the process, sharing its technology, scientific research, and common knowledge along the way. And that's about all the time we have for this week's show. I've been covered that way. On behalf of myself and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
In the limelight.
In the United States, approximately 36 million tons of food, between 30 to 40% of the food supply, is wasted every year. In the United Kingdom, households waste 4.5 million tons of food each year. In Australia, nearly 7.3 million tons of food is wasted. Associated with food waste are the economic costs that arise from the resources used to produce food. For example, farmers use 1.8 billion pounds of nitrogen fertilizer and 1.5 billion pounds of phosphorus fertilizer annually to grow wasted crops, whilst applying more than 750 million pounds of pesticide to protect food that often ends up wasted. According to the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, direct economic consequences of food wastage, excluding fish and seafood, run to the tune of $750 billion annually. All these depressing statistics can lead people to think individual actions would not make a difference. However, in the fight against food waste, everyone's contribution matters. So what can individuals, businesses, and